From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC in Los Angeles, it's the Frame Grammys Special. The Grammys are a great opportunity to hear from the biggest names in music.
What I love is that when people listen to my music, they put on a Lizzo suit or a Lizzo mind frame, and they feel emboldened.
Lizzo celebrates self-love, jazz singer Esperanza Spalding talks musical healing, and rapper Meek Mill speaks his mind about our criminal justice system.
When I got out of prison, I wanted to explain my mind frame, where I come from, being locked in a cell 23 hours a day, that could do something to you mentally.
And flamenco pop star Rosalia says that reinventing a genre comes at a cost.
I guess that when you do something with risk, that risk makes you connect with a lot of people and not connect with a lot of people too.
I'm John Horn. It's the Frame Grammy Special. Stick around. Welcome to the Frame Grammy Special. I'm John Horn. The Grammys are the music industry's most prestigious awards. There are about 12,000 voting members in the Recording Academy, and they are artists, producers, engineers, and executives. But that nonprofit is currently in turmoil. Its CEO, Deborah Dugan, was recently put on administrative leave by the board of directors, and both sides have made serious accusations about each other. Dugan, who held her post for less than a year, filed a sexual harassment and discrimination complaint that, among other things, accuses a Grammy committee of inside dealing when it comes to determining the final nominees for the major awards. So now there is a dark cloud over the 62nd annual ceremony, which will take place on January 26th, but the show will go on. So on this Grammy special, we'll spotlight a wide range of nominees and celebrate the music they make. And we'll start with the artist who led the pack with 8 nominations.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, don't say it because I know I'm cute. Ooh, Louis down to my drawers, LV all on my shoes.
Lizzo is a 31-year-old singer, songwriter, flutist, and rapper. She's been building buzz since her debut album in 2013. This year, she blew up to superstar level. 'Cause I Love You is nominated for Album of the Year, and Truth Hurts is up for Record and Song of the Year. Not too long ago, Lizzo gave me a tour of her L.A. studio. It's not far from Dodger Stadium.
I feel like I'm in nature, so I'm not, like, in a casino of a studio where it's, like...
Outside, there's a tranquil garden where she goes to find inspiration.
I come to this, like, exact spot a lot when I'm stuck on lyrics, stuck on, like, stupid, stuck on someone... something like a bad emotion. I'll just stand right here and just kind of look, and I'm too scared to like go down there because there's always bees.
But we started with her approach to live performances. Here's my conversation with Lizzo.
I didn't say, okay, being pantless on stage is going to be this statement. And it was like, no, I just didn't like wearing pants on stage. And I think I have really nice legs and I wanted to show them off. Like, I think that everything that I'm doing and just being myself is the statement.
How important is it that people who follow you, follow any artist, like do something on their own, that they're empowered to go out and help change the world?
I am all about no call to actions. Like, I'm very anti call to action. I never want to tell anyone what to do because I don't want anyone preaching to me. I'm not a preacher. I'm a musician and I'm a singer. So what I love is that when people listen to my music, they put on a Lizzo suit or a Lizzo mask or a Lizzo mind frame, and they feel emboldened. But the reality is my music is what I'm going through, and I created to help myself. Like, I wrote Good as Hell a year ago to help me now, you know? I'm performing it on stage. I'm like... so sad all day, and then I get on stage because it's my job, and as I'm singing Good as Hell sometimes, I'm just like, oh, I wrote this for me, you know? So I'm glad that people feel that too, because I never want to be the person that's like, well, this is what you need to do, because like, I'm the shit. No, I'm not the shit, but I want to be the shit, and I believe that I can be the shit, and this is how.
There's also a line in Truth Hurts that I think is kind of consistent with what you're singing about. And the line is, you're supposed to hold me down, but you're holding me back. And that's a sound of me not calling you back. A lot of what you're singing about is like, I'm not going to take it anymore. If you think that's the way you're going to behave, see ya.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, of all the lines in that song for you to quote, that's funny. I'm like, where's the bad one? But no, that one is, that one's interesting too, because that's real. And you know, like, a lot of people have taken why are men great until they have to be great into, it's not man hating, it's not man bashing, it's not male bashing, right? They thought about that in terms of like men who are in power. Like, you are the president of the United States. You have the highest seat, you know, of office in this country. You are the most powerful person in this country, among one of the most powerful in the world. But that doesn't mean you're a great person, you know? And only a man has held that seat. Why are all these men so great until they have to be great and take care of us? And a lot of people have taken that and made it political and made it social in their head. It's not just about a breakup. It's not just a romance song. It's about how we need to do better. You know, these men in power who abuse women, these men in the entertainment industry who think they can just get by with their abusive behavior because they're in this high powered seat. Like, you are so great. You've made great movies. You've produced great films. You've made great music, but you're not a great person, you know? And I wish that you could be as great as this power you've been given.
Lizzo, thanks so much for coming on The Frame.
Thank you.
Why are men great till they gotta be great? Woo. I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm 100% that even when I'm crying crazy. Yeah, I got boy problems.
You're listening to The Frame's Grammy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, and joining me now is Amanda Petrusich. She writes about music and culture for The New Yorker. Amanda, welcome to the show.
John, thanks so much for having me.
How would you begin to explain the phenomenon that is Lizzo?
Sure. Well, Lizzo feels very representative to me of our cultural moment insofar as she is an artist who is just so unapologetically herself. She's really joyful. She's fearless. She approaches her life and work from this place of radical self-acceptance. And I think that's really inspiring for people, particularly right now when the future feels kind of uncertain and the ground beneath our feet feels really tenuous. Truth Hurts and Good as Hell, which were the two big pop singles from that record, are really songs about being happy even when external forces seem to be conspiring against you. They're about not accepting the kind of hurtful stuff that, you know, the world might be foisting upon you. So it's this sort of evergreen kind of empowering message, and I think people just needed to hear it right now.
And it's true not only in her lyrics, but in her performance, that there is a way that she performs that is saying, I don't care if you're going to judge me for what I look like or how I dance. This is who I am, and take it or leave it.
Absolutely.
Lizzo is also up for Best New Artist, which is a little weird since her first album came out 7 years ago. The Recording Academy's eligibility guidelines say the honor is for a new artist who releases during the eligibility year the first recording which establishes the public identity of that artist. Okay, we can argue about whether or not that's true for Lizzo, but it's certainly the case for the rock band Black Pumas. The psych rock duo formed in Austin, Texas, and released its first self-titled debut album in 2019.
Hey guys, my name is Eric Burton.
My name is Adrian Quesada.
We're the Black Pumas.
I had started working on some instrumentals that I was writing and looking for somebody to collaborate with on that. Put the feelers out, and a mutual friend of ours recommended Eric and told me this is the best singer I've ever worked with. And sent him a few songs. It took him a while to get back to me. I was like, oh man, this dude's blowing me off. And then I started questioning the whole thing. I'm like, maybe these songs aren't even any good. When he finally got back to me, he called, and or maybe we emailed, but then he called one day and was like, check this out. And he was singing on the phone, and just that like passion and energy from the phone was what really did it for me. I remember trading a bunch of texts. We were just trying to come up with a band name. I had been in Mexico City, and I'd just gone to the pyramids, and jaguars and the kind of like jungle cat figures pretty prominently in a lot of old history.
I knew he was high when he was sending me the names. I'm like, hey, yo, man, this guy is really into cats right now. You know what I mean? Like,
I woke up to the morning sky first. Baby blue, just like we rehearsed.
when I write lyrics, I try to make it everyone's, you know, while at the same time being real with who I am and who we are as individuals, where we come from, our experiences, backgrounds. You know, I think people can tell that we're Hispanic and Black, dressed in the genre that is soul music, but like, I want to be exactly who I am while inviting everyone to the venue.
Yeah, we just bringing people together to celebrate, rejoice, or just come fall in love, and you know, whatever.
In a way that allows you to escape too. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the juice right there. It's the sauce. With all my favorite
clothes. That was Adrian Quesada and Eric Burton from Black Pumas. They're nominated for Best New Artist. This is The Frame's Grammy special from KPCC in Los Angeles.
I'm Amanda Petrasich.
And I'm John Horn. So, Amanda, I want to talk now about four-time Grammy winner Roseanne Cash. This year, she's up for Best American Roots Song. And we should note, though she may be country music royalty by birth, Roseanne Cash doesn't really consider herself part of the Nashville mainstream. I want to ask you about Roseanne Cash and what typically makes someone a good contender in this category. And like a lot of categories, it seems a little amorphous.
Right. Americana roots. You know, I wrote an entire book years back about the idea of Americana, and even I couldn't get to the bottom of it, you know, let alone apply some really strict musical parameters to it. You know, Roseanne Cash obviously has a kind of remarkable pedigree. Her father is Johnny Cash. You know, and she writes songs that are really narrative and I think kind of rooted in place and certainly rooted in her musicality. But at the same time, she lives in New York City. You know, it's not like she exclusively plays a banjo or there's other some sort of musical marker we could tie her to. So it is sometimes, I think, a little, well, why is she nominated in this category and not a different one? I think one thing that's been really holding the Grammys back is they're so tethered to genre. And the categories kind of force this strange sort of parsing of, well, this person does this and this artist does this. And sort of it seems like such an odd way to think about music in 2020, where I don't think artists are considering genre anymore at all. I think the whole idea feels kind of outmoded. It's a strange relic of the time in which people used to go to record stores. And so records would be organized by genre as a sort of marketing tool. But yeah, Americana roots. I don't know.
I don't know either, and I think the Grammys probably don't know either. Here's Roseanne Cash talking about her Grammy-nominated song, Crossing to Jerusalem, which she wrote with her husband, John Leventhal.
That song is about mortality. It's about a long-term relationship and realizing that it's inevitable that one of you is going to leave the other at some point.
This is our great migration, our mountain and our stone.
And, you know, I wrote about loss in my memoir, too. I said, loss is the terrible club to which we all eventually belong. Because you live long enough, you lose.
We'll be crossing to Jerusalem with nothing but a love.
You know, some part of me thought people are not going to want to hear this. It's too dark, but I have to do it even if it's for myself because these are the songs I wrote and they're powerful to me.
Birthdays and the babies, the bourbon and the tears.
At the same time, taking the raw material of grief or rage or trauma or longing or loss, you know, all of those things, and using them to create, I mean, that's as old as time. People started coming up to me, thanking me, thank you, I lost my dad, this helped me. And that was incredibly humbling and beautiful because you think you're so special and you have original emotions. No, it's universal.
That was Roseanne Cash talking about her Grammy-nominated song, Crossing to Jerusalem. Now, J.S. Ondara. He's a singer-songwriter from Kenya, and as a kid, he fell in love with the music of Bob Dylan. His album Tales of America is nominated in the Best Americana category. Here's J.S. Ondara in a live session recorded at our sister station, The Current, in Minneapolis.
He was just an American dream. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my mom would give me money to go to school, and I, you know, like a bus fare. And instead of going to school, I'd just go to the internet cafe and just consume music.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one?
Growing up listening to all this Bob Dylan, it felt like I was in a spaceship and I was traveling to a completely different universe where they... Everyone spoke a different language. Everyone, you know, looked different. They sounded different. They did different things. It's just, it was this, it was a spaceship. That's what music was for me as a child. And it transported me to somewhere.
I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans.
As the internet became a thing and I started spending all my days on the internet instead of going to school. Sorry, Mom. the idea of what a success in music could be was forming at that point, when I could see performances of, you know, people performing online and thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe I could do that. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe.
Waiting on a plane.
When you're in different places outside of America and you're thinking about America, you don't necessarily think of New York or LA, you just think of America, because it's this huge place that you see on TV. And since I was in high school and I was discovering Dylan, and I was like, okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to Minnesota, and I think I'm going to try to start a career in music. And so the first thing I did was apply to the University of Minnesota, tried applying to, you know, jobs and everything, tried everything really, nothing really ever worked until it did, just by pure chance at some point, like when I'm about to give up.
Will you
It ended up being just a thing of putting one foot in front of the next, you know, learning the guitar, started putting all these poems and stories I was writing into melodies, and, you know, got out there, started playing these songs. As soon as I could, I figured out a few chords, and this is it. This is what I came here to do. It's precisely this, is to tell stories and to travel around the world telling them.
Are you averse to honesty? Will you dare to hear?
J.S. Ondara's Tales of America is nominated in the Best Americana category. Coming up on the Frame Grammy special, the artist who goes by Her is up for Best Album for the second straight year.
The heartache of mine. Oh, God, Miss America.
Welcome back to the Frame Grammy special. I'm John Horn. Because the Recording Academy's arcane eligibility guidelines don't follow the calendar year, it's possible for an artist to release albums almost 2 years apart and still be nominated in consecutive years. That's the case for the artist who goes by Her, H-E-R.
Stare out the window.
Last year, she was nominated for 5 Grammys and won 2, Best R&B Album and Best R&B Performance. And she's nominated for another 5 Grammys this year. I Used to Know Her is up for Album of the Year, and Hard Place is up for Record and Song of the Year. By the way, a lot of fans know this artist's real name, but she prefers to be known by her adopted acronym, which ironically stands for Having Everything Revealed.
With social media, I think that's one of the main things people focus on is looks and who you're associated with and all the stuff that is superficial to me, you know. So I really wanted people to just listen to the music. I wanted the music to be the forefront. So I think it would have been a little bit different knowing, you know, my age and my name, seeing my face, all those things I think would have played a role in how they receive my music. And I didn't want that to happen.
And for people who don't know, HER is an acronym for Having Everything Revealed. What do those words mean to you about what you reveal and what you and how you see your own life revealed in music?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say like, oh, we really don't know her. She's hiding. But I always say I'm not hiding. If anything, you know more about me than you ever would. within my music, you know, not knowing what I look like. It's all in the music, and I'm having everything revealed in the music. That is the most honest version of me.
One of the things that I think is true about certain songs, and certainly true about your music, is that the more personal and specific it is, the more universal it can become.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that idea is amplified by the fact that since people don't really know you, they can project much more of themselves into the stories they're hearing lyrically.
Absolutely. I think her is like everybody. It's because, like you said, it's specific to me and specific to my life. The way that I've presented it and the way that people have taken it is just, it can be so many situations and different scales, you know, different levels.
A lot of your songs have co-writers. You've worked with artists like Daniel Caesar, Bryson
yes.
Tiller, and it seems like collaborations are really important to your music. How do you know when you found a good partner, and what does that person need to bring to the table, and how does it change the way that you are as a musician?
I guess for me, when I'm in the studio, one way I like to start my sessions is just talking. I like to talk about life, and I really need to kind of trust the person. It takes me a minute to warm up to somebody, so I have to talk with them and kind of get to know them and really get a vibe for that person and them get a vibe for me, you know, in order for us to create a song together. So that's number one. It's all about the vibe and how we are on a personal level, because all the people that I write with, you know, I sometimes share my stories, but, you know, I like to talk.
Her, thanks so much for coming on the show. Good luck at the Grammys.
Thank you so much.
What if nothing ever will change? Oh, I'm caught between your love and a hard place.
Oh, Her is nominated for 5 Grammys, including Best New Artist and Album of the Year. Her song, Hard Place, is up for Record and Song of the Year. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to the Frames Grammy Special from KPCC in Los Angeles.
I'm Amanda Petrusich.
Rosalia is our next Grammy-nominated artist. In the past year, the Spanish singer's career has skyrocketed, and she's also in the Best New Artist category. Amanda, what do you think about Rosalia?
Well, Rosalia is the only artist who performs exclusively in Spanish to ever be nominated for Best New Artist. So I think the hope here is that she perhaps represents some opening up of a metaphorical border, in a sense, that the Academy might be willing to recognize art that made a significant impact in American culture, even if the artist is not necessarily American. On top of that, I just think she's, you know, she's cool. She's a once-in-a-generation talent. I feel like even though I don't speak Spanish, her vocal phrasing, her vocal rhythms are just remarkable. You know, and she has whatever that ineffable quality is that just makes someone magnetic. It's so fun to watch her and listen to her sing.
Is it important that Rosalia will also be performing during this year's ceremony?
Absolutely, I think so. I think especially the way the Grammy telecast is structured, so few of the actual awards are given out during the television broadcast. It is a really performance-heavy show. So I think getting a performance slot at the Grammys is a great way to kind of reach a, you know, a broader audience than maybe what previously she'd been accessing. She's also, you know, a really compelling performer. It's fun to watch her move. It's fun to watch her kind of be on stage. So I think it's really cool she's performing.
Let's meet Rosalia. This is a profile from the Frame contributor Beto Arcos. He caught up with a singer in Madrid.
Rosalia is from a small town in Catalonia. She's 25 years old and grew up listening to the music her parents played at home, the Beatles, Queen, Supertramp. Then, when she was 13, flamenco entered her consciousness.
I heard it in the street with my friends. They were like older than me. They had the cars with the doors open, hearing the music super loud in the street. They used to hear flamenco. They used to hear Camarón.
Camarón de la Isla is considered the top flamenco figure of the 20th century.
In Camarón, it was like something that changed my life completely. It was like before and after Camarón, you know? I fell in love with his music and the way he used his voice. He was so inspiring for my generation, and he was very open-minded. He always took risks doing his records.
Rosalía is also taking risks on her own records. Many in the traditional flamenco community criticized her first album called Los Angeles. Among other things, she was accused by a Roma activist of cultural appropriation.
I guess that when you do something with risk, that risk makes you connect with a lot of people and not connect with a lot of people too.
Rosalía's new album is a departure from the previous one. If the first album was minimalist, guitar and voice, this one has many layers of production and influences, from electronic music to R&B.
Ese gritalito roto, yo sentí como crujía.
It's flamenco for the 21st century, inspired by an anonymous novel from the Middle Ages called Flamenca. Rosalía says there are some traditional flamenco melodies, but there are many pieces she composed specifically for it. It's also a concept album.
And every song is a chapter. There's a whole story in the record, which is El Mal Querer, this bad loving, this story about a dark love.
Rosalía can only guess what the late legend Camarón de la Isla would say if he heard her music today. She certainly knows what she would say to him if she had the chance.
Because of him, I'm here. He changed my life when I was 13, and he's been like the most inspiring icon and musician from my country for me. And he's been so important. He was the door that I opened to discover all this music, and I love him.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. En Madrid, Spain.
That was Best New Artist nominee Rosalía. This is The Frame's Grammy special from KPCC in Los Angeles.
I'm Amanda Petrasich.
And I'm John Horn. Singer and songwriter Andrew Bird has played classical, jazz, folk, and rock, and on top of all that, he's one of the best whistlers out there. Plus, he's an actor in the new season of Fargo. Since 1996, the prolific artist has released 15 full-length albums. Bird hasn't sung about politics that much, but in his most recent album, called My Finest Work Yet, he mixes political commentary, oddball musings, and historical references. It got him a nomination for Best Folk Album. Before Bird was a full-time songwriter, he played for Tips. He told us about that experience when he dropped by the Frame Studios.
At some point in my early 20s, I was working at a Renaissance fair.
Were you like grilling the big turkey legs or something?
No, but I was just a run-of-the-mill fiddling surf. And I got tendonitis really bad from... I was just playing way too much, and it wasn't the most amount of value put upon my playing at that moment. When you're playing for people waiting to go to the bathroom. I got tendonitis really bad, and I had to stop, and that's when I was like, I'd become so focused on mastering this instrument that I'd forgotten that I had more to offer. You know, I used to write more, I used to read more, and that's when I started really getting into writing.
I want to play a track from the new album. This one is called Bloodless.
And it feels like 1936 in Catalonia. In Catalonia.
Catalonia, boy, what a great word to sing, but that is the start of the Spanish Civil War, right? So when you're thinking about that lyric, how does it come into the song and why is it important to you?
First of all, singing Watergate doesn't sound very good. Or, you know, some other more current thing would just fall flat. And you know what I mean? It's just, it's too close to the current events don't play well in songs. So finding something in our recent history that I think is illuminating. I read George Orwell's Ode to Catalonia, and that had an impression on me where he got kind of caught between different factions on the left and got in big trouble, almost got executed. And meanwhile, the fascists are united with their fairly simple, though terrible message. and the left is infighting and can't pull together.
At what point do you say to yourself, this song needs whistling? And at what point do you say, less is more? How do you figure out where whistling comes in? Because it's such an integral part of your sound.
Yeah, it really cuts through. When I used to go off playing solo years ago, and I had to, people didn't know who I was, it was a great way to quiet the room, because I would just fill my lungs with air and hold a note until people said, what is that? And then they would be like, oh, there's a guy over there playing.
Put down their beer, stop throwing darts, and actually listen.
I think it usually wins, not just because of its sonics, but just because it's a very honest way that I whistle all day long, so why would I stop when I go on stage?
Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Andrew Bird's My Finest Work Yet is nominated for Best Folk Album. If you're just joining us, this is The Frame's Grammy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn.
I'm Amanda Petrusich.
So next up, we've got the indie rock outfit Big Thief. They are up for Best Alternative Music Album. They also made Barack Obama's year-end list of his favorite music. Before we hear from them, Amanda, I wanted to hear your thoughts on Big Thief and more specifically on whether or not you think its nomination offers any insight into how the Recording Academy has traditionally recognized indie rock music.
Well, like Barack Obama, Big Thief is one of my favorite bands right now. They released two great albums in 2019, and the one that's titled UFOF is the one that's nominated in this category. You know, funnily enough, the Grammys have been really open in the past decade or so to artists who are working in the indie rock idiom, for lack of a better term. And some of the big surprise winners, I think, of the last 10 years have been indie rock bands that managed to, you know, to take home a Grammy in some of the big major categories. In 2012, Bon Iver, who's always been signed to Jag Jaguar, which is a great indie label based in Bloomington, Indiana, won Best New Artist. You know, he beat Nicki Minaj, Skrillex, J. Cole. Arcade Fire won Album of the Year in 2012, beat Lady Gaga, beat Katy Perry, beat Eminem. Beck beat Beyonce for Album of the Year in 2015 for his record Morning Face. So I think we are seeing Grammy voters kind of acknowledging indie rock bands over big pop acts.
Let's hear from the members of Big Thief. They're talking about their Grammy-nominated album, UFOF.
UFOF stands for Unidentified Flying Object Friend. You know, you spend a long time just hoping and searching the skies for this terrifying but incredible thing that represents contact with some layer of the unknown, and then suddenly there's this realization. What if the extraterrestrials actually just check us out and then pass us by because it's too toxic of an environment? So that's an even scarier thought. What if they don't land? We worked, from basically when we woke up to when we were too tired.
Very intense.
For 3.5 solid weeks. But we got really into playing soccer every day because we'd hit a wall and then go take a break and play for an hour and sweat. And I think that was actually so imperative because we were playing, but not playing music. Like, I felt like it was helping us learn how to, like, dive into a deeper layer of our interaction or something.
Yeah, being in this studio is such a tender balance of pushing to unearth your own subjective vision or sound and then like surrendering to the perspective of others who you trust.
And that's why
but
I
it's always like a dance back and forth.
That's why it's so important that so much of what we're doing is building just our relationships with each other.
Oh yeah.
And like for that song Betsy, I was totally joking. Like I was just like driving through the night, driving through the night.
And then I was like, chills.
In the control, I was just like, oh my God, Adrian, keep going.
And then I was like, wow, I didn't even know I could sing that low. And then I was like, all right.
The whole philosophy is like, once everyone's has chills, or like once like Dom is like walking out of the room crying, it's like, this is it, right? But, you know, like that, like, what are we doing if not that, you know?
Big Thief is nominated for Best Alternative Music Album. When we come back, the rapper Meek Mill talks about a song from his Grammy-nominated album Championships and the false conviction that inspired it. Welcome back to The Frame's Grammy Special. I'm John Horn.
I'm Amanda Petrasich. John, who's next?
How about Esperanza Spalding? She is a bassist, she's a singer, she's a Harvard professor, and her music is typically filed under jazz, but I think she has a lot of hip-hop, R&B, prog rock. She won Best New Artist back in 2011, but since then seems to be relegated to jazz-only categories. So we've talked a lot about Grammy categories. It feels like Esperanza Spalding is a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really fair. I think she is someone who's kind of pulling from all corners of, you know, musical history and synthesizing those sounds in a way that's really exciting. But we are seeing her, you know, being nominated chiefly in the jazz categories. And she was such a surprise win in 2011 when she took home Best New Artist. You know, she beat Justin Bieber. She beat Drake. I mean, these names that went on to be massive pop stars.
Let's hear a little bit from Esperanza Spalding. Her album 12 Little Spells is up for Best Jazz Vocal Album. It's a collection of 12 songs, each corresponding to a different body part.
Truthfully, I don't know how the idea came up. Like many ideas I've had for projects, it's kind of like blank, it enters the imagination all at once. It was probably the fruit of just absorbing a lot of information about the relationship between music and healing and our nervous system and emotional trauma, psychological trauma.
You figured out so much up there on your own now.
It's free form. It's not grounded in quote unquote science per se. But I'm borrowing the science from experience as an artist that we do create illusions to generate a sensation in the body. I keep coming back to the treatment that's available for phantom limb syndrome. And we know that individuals who suffer from that experience physical pain. You can see it in their brain. And so far, the only treatment, the only therapy that helps is creating illusions for the patient. And to me, that is like a beautiful example from, you know, bona fide science that creating creative illusions can help the body heal at the anatomical level.
That was singer and bassist Esperanza Spalding. Meek Mill is a rapper from Philadelphia. Back in 2007, he was arrested on a gun charge at the age of 19, and over the past 11 years, he was sent to prison 4 times for parole violations. But last summer, based on evidence of alleged police corruption, the Pennsylvania Superior Court threw out his conviction and the parole violation that had led to his most recent time in prison. Meek Mill has released 5 albums. His most recent, Championships, is nominated for a Grammy for Best Rap Album. Here he is in an excerpt from the podcast Song Exploder, talking about a song from that album titled Trauma.
I go by the name of Meek Mill. When I got out of prison, I wanted to explain my mind frame, where I come from, being locked in a cell 23 hours a day. That could do something to you mentally. My mama used to pray that shit, see me. As a kid, from the age of a toddler to like 10 years old, I used to love playing the game. I used to get A's and B's. And then when I start going outside on my front step, people was getting shot. They were selling drugs. Of course, I got tangled up in a life. I had to protect myself. I had to feed myself. At the age of 19, I caught a case, a gun case. I was charged with a bunch of bogus charges, beat by the police. Was on probation for 11 years, sent to prison 4 times. And along the process, I dedicated myself to making music. And I never turned back. I just want to give people a bird's eye view of the story I had to walk and many others had to walk. That's kind of silent. When I say I seen my brother's blood on the pavement, hey, you wake up in the morning feeling evil. Basically like seeing one of your homies, your friends, your family members shot down. If you see too much of that, you'll start waking up in the morning and feeling evil. feeling like you want to get revenge, feeling like you want to protect yourself, or you might want to kill or do anything or harm someone else because you're enduring so much trauma and hate. In my neighborhood, this one kid, the last one left, all four brothers was killed. He carrying a gun in the neighborhood. And the guys that killed all four of his brothers, they probably going to kill him too. So, you know, he trying to defend himself and he getting something and catch a case. And, you know, when we go in court for carrying a gun, we can't go in there and say, Your Honor, I'm paranoid. If you check the data in my neighborhood, there was 300 kids that looked like me murdered this year in my neighborhood. That's why I was carrying a gun. That doesn't work for black and brown men in court. Do you think they ever even bring post-traumatic stress up in the courtroom? They label you a gang member or a thug. They don't even bring it up. They don't base it off of circumstance. They don't base it off of mental health, post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that fair? Do y'all see that as fair? Yeah, it ain't fair at all. You might ride through the hood or the ghetto, and you might see kids on the corner, and their face might be balled up and frowned up. You know, people automatically classify him. He's a bad guy. He's dangerous. He might be dangerous, but his dad might be in the graveyard. His mom might be on drugs. He probably been to 10 funerals this year. You know, it's hard to really fix your face and fix your image and to seem to be happy when you've been through these type of things. So where we come from, it's a different world.
Thanks to our friend Hrishikesh Hirway for allowing us to excerpt that piece with Meek Mill from the podcast Song Exploder. The R&B singer-songwriter Emily King is just 34 years old, but she's already had a long career. She released her first album, East Side Story, in 2007, and though it earned her a Grammy nomination for Best Contemporary R&B Album, she was later dropped by her label because of poor sales. King has since released two more acclaimed albums. Her most recent is called Scenery, and it includes Look at Me Now, which is nominated for Best R&B Song.
Hey, my name is Emily King. I'm a musician and songwriter from New York City.
Are you hearing about me? How you dealing without me? Hello.
Look at Me Now. I had had that intro. Are you hearing about me? For like years. And then I played it for Jeremy. And he was like, no, it should be this. Look at me now. And I was like, that's so swaggy. I love it.
Did you hear about me? I got off the ground. I stood up when you left me, baby. Look at me now.
But it was just so much fun. And some of my favorite music is like attitude driven. At one point during this album process, I was getting so heady about songwriting, and I just wanted to write the perfect song, and how do I do that, and let me listen to the songs I think are great. And my buddy Shervin Lanez, he said something along the lines of, I don't want you to write a perfect song, I want to know how you feel. And I was like, now I have to get in touch with my feelings? That's the last thing I want to do. But it really struck a chord with me, because I thought, I know all the great songs were from a feeling, but how do I get in touch with my feelings? Because at the time I was feeling really bored just with my existence because I was living with my mom. And so that's when I knew I gotta make a change. This is gonna be stressful. And I moved upstate and I learned how to drive, and that triggered a feeling inside of me.
Been without it for so long. Forgot what it feels like.
I started singing this melody and it turned into Remind Me, and it really was just a feeling. But I had to go through all of this other stuff to make it happen for myself.
That was Emily King talking about her album Scenery and the song Look at Me Now, which is up for Best R&B Song. I'm John Horn. You're listening to the Frames Grammy Special.
I'm Amanda Petrusich.
So Amanda, next up, David Crosby. You wrote about Crosby when the documentary Remember My Name came out. I think you noted he has his own strain of cannabis. What else did you find interesting about him through this documentary and through his history in music?
Sure. I've heard exclusively through the grapevine that his strain of cannabis is quite strong. I believe it's called the Mighty Cross. But I learned, a lot from that film. I found it really haunting. It was sort of predicated on the idea that David Crosby is living on borrowed time. And he's released so much music in the last few years, and he's been really active on Twitter. But the film kind of showed that he has not been able to do the hard, maybe impossible work of making amends with the people that he's hurt. So I just found it really moving to sort of watch this person at the end of, presumably at the end of their life, or at least getting close to it, kind of trying to figure out, how to reckon with his legacy. The film also contains many compelling David Crosby facts, one of which I had no idea about, which is that Phil Collins actually paid for David Crosby's liver transplant. I also learned that David Crosby fathered via sperm donation a child that Melissa Etheridge had with her former partner.
His life and all those ups and downs, including a stint in prison, is the subject of the documentary, and it's nominated for Best Music Film. The movie was produced by Cameron Crowe, was directed by A.J. Eaton, and I sat down with Crosby and the filmmakers at last year's Sundance Film Festival. Here's David Crosby.
I don't think there's anything there I didn't know already, wasn't aware of already. But anytime you're confronted with the truth, the real question is, did you learn anything from it? The information on who those guys are and what they think has been there long before this documentary. I knew them for 40 years. I know who they are and I know what they're thinking. The way we consider it in the documentary, I think, is the way we treated it, I thought was as good as we could. We didn't slag anybody. We didn't blame anybody else. I'm more than willing to take blame for anything that happened in that group. I'll take more blame than anybody. But we all did horrible stuff to each other.
We as an audience watching this movie learn a lot about you, not just about your music, but about your life and about your health, about the people who are important to you. When you watch the movie, do you learn something about yourself that maybe you didn't quite recognize?
I learned how badly I want to be a decent human being, because I've been other than a decent human being, and it's not fun. I was a junkie. It doesn't get any lower than that. So I learned that it matters to me tremendously. Even though I don't want to admit I care what people think, it matters. It matters how I look at myself. And doing this has made it easier for me to look at myself.
How do you hope people might be changed and their understanding of you might be changed?
I would hope that they would think that I wasn't just a rambunctious asshole. I would hope that they thought could see that there was a thought process behind most of what I did. Not all, but most. And I think that I'm a good lesson in the sense that I'm a very imperfect being. It's blatantly obvious.
David Crosby has a Grammy nomination for Best Music Film. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young performed at Woodstock in 1969, and their performance was part of a compilation released last year titled Woodstock Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive. Music producer Andy Zak spent 14 years restoring all 3 days of audio from the Woodstock Festival, and instead of a slick production, he chose to keep everything in: helicopter noise, thunder, stage announcements, and he uncovered performances previously written out of history. Amanda, have you had a chance to listen to some of this collection?
I have. It's overwhelming. But that is nominated in, I believe, the Best Historical Album category, which is a category, again, because I'm an enormous nerd, I always keep a bit of an eye on. I feel like some of those smaller categories that are announced earlier in the day at the pre-telecast are really fascinating. That's when a music fan can kind of discover releases, she may not have heard about, things that are really rich, that have, significance, things that are pulled out of archives by people like Andy Zak, who are, really thorough researchers and really dedicated to kind of telling the story of the music that they're discovering or rediscovering. So that box set, God, a person could listen to that for several years and still not maybe make sense of all of it.
Andy Zak talked with us about the moment that he encountered the Woodstock tapes in a storage facility in Los Angeles.
I really wanted this to be an accurate representation of Woodstock because I felt like all of the previous audio documentation of Woodstock, going back to that original 3LP soundtrack album that came out in 1970, all of it had been tweaked, sweetened, faked, augmented. Just there was a high level of fraud that had been present on virtually every previous release of Woodstock audio until I got a hold of those tapes.
What a lovely dream it was.
Okay, so you hear John Sebastian fading out, and you heard those crickets there in the background? Those are fake. Those came off a sound effects reel. I found it sitting in the tape archive along with everything else. It's part of the factual record of Woodstock that was, in fact, a whole bunch of fake crickets. And that's right at the beginning. And so the whole audio record of Woodstock, right virtually from the start, had been distorted, let's say.
What a lovely dream it was.
What Woodstock actually sounds like. You're not hearing fake crickets, for one thing, and you're hearing a real audience response, and you're kind of hearing a little bit of movement on stage. To me, that's the real Woodstock. If you embrace that version of Woodstock, it sounds better.
Can you hear? Groovy.
That was Andy Zaks. He produced Woodstock, Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive. It's up for Best Historical Album. And that'll do it for the Frames Grammy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Horn. I host The Frame, which you can get as a podcast wherever you like to listen. Amanda Petrusich is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes about music and culture. You can follow her on Twitter at Amanda Petrusich. And you can check out her articles in The New Yorker magazine and at newyorker.com. This special is a production of KPCC in Los Angeles. It was produced by Jonathan Shiflett, Darby Maloney, and Monica Bushman, with help from Beto Arcos, Stephen Cuevas, and Paul Ratliff. Our engineer is Eduardo Perez, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza.
Freedom, freedom, freedom.